Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Michael Morris. Apologies for yesterday if you were experiencing any of the sound issues. That was my mistake, and hopefully those are sorted for this coming episode. Let's get into the news of today, however, and that is that Joburg has announced that it will be throttling water supply to the city between 9 o'clock at night and 4 o'clock in the morning. This is an attempt to basically rebuild the reservoirs while they are running low due to just too much usage. In this case, mostly it seems being caused by leaks from the municipal water system. The new measures are set to start on November 14th, so tomorrow, and will be implemented continuously until the system has fully recovered. But it's not clear when exactly that will be. This is also in addition to the implementation of level one water restrictions, which are normally only implemented during droughts. And these are not too odious. They're just that you're not allowed to use hose pipes to water gardens, wash cars, clean driveways, or fill up swimming pools between 6 and 6. So basically during the daylight hours. Those restrictions are set to remain in place until at least the 31st of March 2025. Michael, we've seen the municipal crisis in Joburg get more and more severe, and I think the water stuff is really kind of the spear point of the entire crisis. While Joburg has managed to, I think, resolve the electricity stuff that we talked about last week, which is that it has agreed to pay its bill to Eskom after disputing that. So luckily, Joburg will not be cut off from electricity supply. The water crisis in Joburg doesn't seem to have any particular end in sight, and I don't think anyone's had a very convincing explanation of how this is going to be turned around anytime soon. What do you make of this story?
I mean, I think there are a lot of aspects to it, and I hope we try and touch on all of them. But one of the first things that came to mind when I was looking at the story earlier was, of course, Cape Town's experience in 2016 to 2018, more or less. And I was just refreshing my memory about some of the aspects of it. One of the very helpful pieces that I came across this morning was from the Stockholm International Water Institute, which begins with a few thoughts that I think are critical. Transparency, information, and behavioral change. This site says saved Cape Town from day zero. So I also happen to think that Cape Town is a little bit different in the sense that what the city was facing, what the politicians directing policy were facing, was in a sense more of a natural crisis. It was something which was visited on the city by the vagaries of the sun and the weather, and it happens every sort of decade and a half or so, and we suddenly confront this thing. It's not entirely that, because of course there's also planning goes into, you know, having a sense of what the weather's likely to be doing over these cycles, and also how many people are moving to the city, how much more water is going to be consumed, and so on. So there's a decided political aspect. But it might be, you know, it could be argued that it's unfair to compare Cape Town's response to that crisis to the one in Johannesburg. And yet, I think at the same time, there's a key aspect here. I think Cape Town succeeded, and if we look at those terms, transparency, information, and behavioral change. This is actually all about the city communicating what the problem was, letting people know exactly this is where we are. And I remember every day everybody would get up and look at the sites, all the various sites that get notifications from the city and so on, about the dam levels. Everybody was an expert on dam levels, on, you know, the number of people in the city, the number, how much water we'd be using. We could see by day the city was calculating the levels of how much water people were using every day. I see in Johannesburg's case at the moment, Gauteng's case, it's estimated at 279 liters a day, which doesn't seem so terribly much. But I see this story in Engineering News points out, I think, that it's something like 60% higher than the average, the world average, which is quite something. I think, 60% above the world average, 279 liters a day. I think a bath typically is about 200 liters. So one of the first things Cape Town people did was to stop bathing. and using the shower, and the shower water went to go down the lavatory. But the key thing there, that I want to come back to the point, that those three words, transparency, information, behavioral change, is all about how the city is communicating with the people about what the crisis is, telling them this is what we're doing about it, and telling them this is what we want you to do about it. And if you do that, these are the benefits. And this is something that we were chatting a bit about before the show, Nicholas, is this question of how you incentivize a city. And here's the thing that I think is critical in if you're looking at the difference between Cape Town and Gauteng, nature versus a problem created by bad politicians, is essentially the public's trust in the process. Even if the city of Joburg would admit that, you know, this is we are to blame and these are the problems that we've created, but this is what we're doing, I think the public trust would be higher. But unfortunately, what we tend to be seeing is none of that. It's just simply an effort to warning people, wagging their finger at people, to saying you've got to reduce your consumption. If you don't, we're going to throttle the supply. I mean, even that verb is a very kind of visceral. A visceral verb to use in this sense, whereas a quite different environment, political and social environment, would be created if people felt that they were being taken into the politicians' trust. If the whole thing was explained to them, they began to incentivize behavioral change. We're now all going to save water together, and in this way, we're going to make life better for everybody across the city. And we get to pull through and get through to the other side. There's none of that, unfortunately. And this was really the key thing, I think, that that made a huge difference in Cape Town's case. And no doubt would in Johannesburg's too. Except that, unfortunately, there is this history of political disdain for people, for the public. And we're going to get to that in a minute. I'll talk about Jonathan Katzenellenbergen's piece in Daily Friend this morning on this very topic.
No, please do go check that out and give it a read if you can. It's a good piece about this stuff. I think one of the problems here is just Joburg's refusal to admit as how much municipal failure is a part of the problem here. There are various estimates of exactly how much water is being lost to leaks in the Joburg water system. I've seen estimates as high as 50%, but I see that there was a recent report in the No Drop report, which found that it was about 35% of all the water in the system was being lost due to leaks and other problems like that. There's also a significant number of people who are not paying for water as well because they've bypassed their meters or whatever. Admitting the truth is kind of first part of building that trust process. And so far, the city's response has mostly just been to blame Rand Water for not supplying them with enough water. Maybe there are problems with the amount of water being supplied. I don't know. I'm not a water engineer. But quite frankly, I think that if the city took some responsibility, it would be able to start building this trust that you talk about as being so important to resolving crises like this. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to our... Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, Michael.
Just to draw attention again to Jonathan's piece this morning. His final sort of two paragraphs sum up the essential point. And he says the ANC might want to appoint a minister of municipalities to try and deal with with all these crises that are beginning to develop at municipal level, but that will fail, he says. The simple and obvious solution is that voters have to evict parties that have brought about municipal failure and put in place parties that have demonstrated an ability and want to use their available powers to properly manage cities. And it really is as simple as that. And I think, fortunately, we are getting to that point in South Africa. Voters do seem to be suddenly waking up to the idea that they do have power in their hands and they are making that choice. So this is a big challenge for all of us, I think.
Yes, and I think Joburg will be one of the very big battlegrounds in the municipal governance elections in 2026.
Indeed.
Okay, our next story is one that we've talked about a little bit, which is this ongoing case of a number of different incidents of children dying from contamination, from poisoning. While it's not entirely clear whether all of these cases are connected, it does seem that in a number of them, the agents that have been identified as why these children in Gauteng have died is because they accidentally ingested some kind of insecticide or pesticide, or just, you know, something very very basically very powerful poisons. Some of these are legally used only for agricultural use. Some of them are entirely illegal, but they are apparently being sold on the black market because they're so powerful that people don't have to buy a lot of them in order for them to work effectively at killing rats and bugs and that sort of thing. So the most infamous of these cases, and the one that sort of all brought this to a head, was when six children died in Naledi in Soweto. Health officials determined that turbofos are the culprit that poisoned these children. However, although a lot of the media reporting has suggested that this was from spaza shops that had perhaps been using these chemicals to kill pests or you know, protect their goods, that actually has not a link that it has not actually yet been proven, and yet it kind of remains so strongly a part of the dialogue on this. Government assures South Africans that our health authorities are thoroughly investigating this and other cases involving the deaths of young people as a result of suspected food poisoning. Anyone found responsible will be held accountable and prosecuted to the full extent of the law, the news story says. An intensive investigation is underway to ascertain the origin of the chemical. And that's why this is so strange, is that so much of the reporting, you know, mentions, as I said, spaza shops and things like that. But it's not clear that that's the source. In fact, I wonder whether there's a much bigger problem here of just generally sort of a culture of slipping health standards. And, you know, who knows where these kids got poisoned by this? It could have been in a whole number of places. Health officials have admitted that these illegal pesticides are fairly widely used in South Africa's poorer areas, despite being illegal, simply due to how effective they are. Michael, what do you make of this? I mean, we've talked at length about how the story has not been particularly well reported in the media, but it's clear that a lot of, I think, the issues here are just the sort of regular ticking over of government, that you maybe could have prevented things like this happening ahead of time if you had just more basic enforcement of municipal bylaws, which just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that immediately strikes me as a kind of red flag is this idea that that is being declared a national security threat and is being dealt with by the National Joint Operational and Intelligence Structure. Well, it strikes me as a major health crisis, which needs, you know, urgent health intervention and inspection of, you know, sources of risk to the public health. But whether it's, you know, a national security threat immediately lifts it into a realm of them and us, of enemies, of, you know, there's some kind of foreign.
Right, the implication is that this is a deliberate attack.
Yeah, yeah. And what a strange thing, and especially when they say that they're still investigating the source, so they don't actually know where it's coming from. They don't really seem to know a great deal. And there is this constant, we've spoken about it, I've written about it in my column, this constant and very sort of focused and deliberate narrative forming around the idea that it's foreign spaza shop owners who are implicitly to blame. And that eventually becomes, you know, it immediately is linked to the idea that we've got to deport illegal foreign shop. So the whole thing is the emphasis of the public discussion about it is all on foreigners, and one wonders, you know, if it's going to be seen as a national security threat, is anybody actually looking at trying to determine the real source of this very grave health threat? I mean, it says here 42, the latest story that I was looking at, 42 school children died. I mean, that's astonishing. But it does speak to me of a lack of control over these kinds of substances. People who bring them into the country, maybe, or who buy them or who sell them, have complete disregard for any of the sort of standard health procedures because presumably they're not being enforced properly. So these are really the things that we need to be looking at. Whether it's a national security threat is another question entirely, and quite a risky one, I would think.
Yeah, the only sort of security aspect I can see of this is if you regard, I don't know, smuggling of these illegal goods into South Africa as the great national security threat. But I think, you know, as long as there's a demand for these things, it's going to be difficult to restrict them. And so there also probably needs to be a kind of public education campaign to say, you know, don't use these pesticides, they will kill your children.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's so many ways that government could tackle this more responsibly. Maybe it is contaminated food that is being sold at spaza shops that is poisoning these children. But the problem is we don't know. And so much of the response has been knee-jerk driven by social media and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, last story for today, very briefly. Not much to say on this one, just kind of, it's sort of hilariously what you would expect. There's debate in Parliament about what happened to the extradition request for the Gupta brothers, who are apparently, I believe, in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And there were a number of issues with getting them extradited. Apparently, the extradition request was turned down by the Emirati officials. Initially, the South African prosecutors don't appear to have been told this. And so the extradition has kind of, you know, become a bit of an administrative mess now. And it's not clear that anything like that is going to happen, even though they know where these guys are. It's all a bit of a mess. And of course, the Gupta brothers were linked to the absolutely enormous corruption scandals in the Zuma administration, the so-called state capture stuff that happened in the mid-2010s. What's really funny, though, is that the MK party has, and I thought this was a bit overly editorializing in the media and the news piece on this, although I do sort of agree with the sentiment. The MK party has continued its campaign against accountability for corruption, with its deputy leader John Tlope suggesting National Director of Public Prosecutions Shamila Batoy was misleading the nation about the Gupta's extradition. John Tlope went on to say in Parliament that he questioned, you know, what exactly the crimes the Guptas were accused of were, and asked a number of questions, you know, as to what their arrest warrants actually said and just other technical details of that. Now, you know, there's a whole moral question about why they're defending the Guptas to begin with. But for me, the more interesting revelation of this is I think this kind of reveals the MK party as really just a corruption protection scheme rather than being a proper focused, ideologically driven political party. There's no reason, politically speaking, why you should have to defend the Guptas unless you know that them being brought to book would, you know, cause massive problems for your entire sort of enterprise. It's just bad politics unless the arrest of these guys would undermine you. Michael, what do you make of this? It's just sort of so bizarre to see people standing up in Parliament on such a radioactive issue as this. If there's one thing that South Africans know about the Zuma era, it's that the Guptas were involved. It just seems crazy to try to defend them.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, the immediate thought comes to mind, what could they possibly say that is progressive about what they're saying here? It simply doesn't make any rational sense other than, as you say, as a reflection of their very great anxiety about where this might lead. So yeah, quite cynical. And yeah, it has the party of Zuma stamped all over it.
It would be nice to see the Gupta brothers return to South Africa, face trial, and reveal what they know about all those deals that were done. I mean, if I was in charge of prosecuting them, I would be willing to offer them all the amnesty in the world if they were willing to give up the goods on all of the people in power who were, you know, taking their money and corrupting the infrastructure of the state. But sadly, I fear that day will not come, at least not anytime soon. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Before you go, do please check out an event we are going to be hosting in the East Rand next week on November the 20th from about 5:30 till 7. Our colleagues Marius Root and Makone Maja will be at the Corporate Conference Center in Edenvale. Please do go check out. I'll put the link in the comments on YouTube. There's a link to a Quicket website. Do sign up for a ticket. The tickets are free. You don't have to pay anything, but we do also want to get an idea of numbers of people who might be interested in coming. So please do book your spot now, and we'll see you tomorrow. That's a wrap. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.